This will now be fourth week. So, if I forgot anyone's name, you know. I'm kidding about that. Okay. It's good to be back between America and now and last week. Tzfat, Baruch Hashem, a little bit of menuchas and nefesh, a little bit of equanimity when we're able to sit back and get back to Parshas Shavuot. This week's Parshas is Parshas Vayakel. Vayakel Moshe et kol hadas bnei Yisrael v'yomer aleihem el hadvarim asher tzivah Hashem la'asos osam. Moshe gathered all of the people of Klal Yisrael. Right? And he told them the following. And what he's about to tell them is Shabbos followed by Melechas HaMishkan. You know. Okay. Just interesting point. Why is it that Moshe had to be Vayakel? The Or HaChaim points out that at all times that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Moshe spoke to them, he used to gather everyone together and speak to them. Why did it go out of its way to say this time Vayakel Moshe, that he gathered the people? That's what the Or HaChaim asks. Tzarech l'da'at tam she'utzrach lomar Vayakel. Why does it have to say Vayakel? Davar ragil b'cholet asher yitzaveh dvar Hashem. That's what he always did. God tells him to speak to the people of Israel, so he got the people of Israel together. So why does it have to say Vayakel? So the Or HaChaim says that it's related to the previous point that we had in last week's Parsha. In last week's Parsha, it ends, V'ra'u v'nei Yisrael et p'nei Moshe ki karan or p'nei Moshe. The Jewish people saw that the countenance of the face of Moshe was different. It suddenly glowed. There was a certain light emanating from Moshe. Right, to the point where he put a certain veil over his face, and that scared the people. And because the people were somewhat, scary is a negative connotation, but the people were so awed by Moshe that they were perhaps nervous to get close to, is this something that's relevant to me anymore? And therefore Moshe had to gather all the people and tell them, yes, this is absolutely relevant to you, and in fact, I would take it a step further, it's not just relevant to you that you can, this is something that you too can attain and achieve. You too can have a glow to your face. I was telling somebody, maybe it's somebody in this room, there's pictures of Gedolim are a big item in Mea Shearim. You can get just about any Gedolim. And one of the Gedolim that you can find over there is the one photograph that they, was it you? Is the one photograph of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. There's maybe one or maybe two photographs that you can find of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Yeah. So there is the picture of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And again, you have to understand that this goes back 100 years, is a picture of him sitting there with his legs crossed, his hands over his, on his lap, like so, and he's peering, and he's got his glasses on the bridge of his nose. It's a passport photo that he took. Towards the end of his life, he was very sick. He was about to be transferred to, he was about to go to Berlin to meet some experts there, but they felt that the trip was too hard for him to take. Not, but in preparation for the trip, he had taken a photo, a passport picture, so that he would be able to cross the border from that time in Poland. He was in a town in Poland trying to recuperate, and they took a passport photo for him to be able to go from Poland to Germany. He never ended up going. But that's the photo that we have. The amazing thing about that photo is I've read in books that the family members say that he did not need glasses. The reason why he has glasses perched on his nose is because his eyes had such a shine and glow to them and were so penetrating. I don't mean penetrating like I know what you did last night. It sometimes intimidated people. And therefore he would wear glasses in order to put people more at ease, in order to hide the brightness of his eyes. The reason why I mention that is because Moshe's lesson of Vayakel Moshe et kol adav bnei Yisrael, don't be frightened, don't be... This is something that's relevant to all of us. This is something that we can all attain and achieve. Such a dveikus to the Torah that we too begin to emanate its light. For some of us, it is hard to even see light emanating from the actual Torah when it's taken out of the Aron. But in fact, we should try to refine ourselves and sensitize ourselves to the point that there is a light glowing, and we should learn to recognize it, see it, and... embrace it and try to in fact make it part of us as well. Anyway, the pasuk continues, board number 2. Pasuk base, Sheshes yamim te'aseh melacha uvayom ha'shvi'i yeh lachem kodesh. 6 days te'aseh melacha. Te'aseh melacha is an odd choice of word. It doesn't say Sheshes yamim ta'ase melacha would mean sheshes yomim, you shall do work, uvayom ashvi, and then the seventh day you should rest. It says, sheshes yomim te'ase melacha. What is te'ase melacha? Work will be done. Te'ase, it will be done. As if to imply that it is done on its own. The question is, why does it not say ta'ase? Right, and what's the context of why do you need to say even that 6 days work will be done and on the seventh you should rest? Why don't you just say on the seventh you shall rest and we'll know by default, okay, 6 days we work, on the seventh we rest. Why did it have to say Te'aseh melacha v'yom ha-shvi'i tishbot? You could have just said v'yom ha-shvi'i yeh lachem kodesh shabbat shabbaton. So Rav Shlomo Gansfried, who was most famously known for, anyone has heard the name of Shlomo Gansfried? Excellent. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. So he's most famously known for the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, but he had a less famous known book called Aparyon, which is his Perush on Chumash. And in it, he says the following. He says that it's very hard to come to the level of Shvita B'Shabbos. If a person believes that he is in fact in charge of his finances, then to tell him, listen, I want you to not work one day a week, is to tell him to take a 1/7 pay cut. I want you to take a, what's 1/7 in percentages? 13%. Approximately. I want you to take approximately a 13% pay cut. Right? You want me to take a 13%? No way. But if a person believes that his parnasa is predetermined, that te'aseh melacha, that the work is really, it's a fake, it's just my hishtadlis, but really HaKadosh Baruch Hu predetermines how much money I'm going to get. He's going to get me the money by hook or by crook, and it doesn't matter how many days a week I'm going to work. Then the Shvita becomes much easier. Then the resting on the seventh day becomes much easier. But so long as a person is convinced that he in fact determines his financial stability and well-being, then it's not going to work. There's a story that the Chafetz Chaim was once alerted to the fact that somebody somebody in Russia, at the time it was the Tsarist government, somebody in Russia, he was in Radin, which was part of Russia, was keeping his business open on Shabbos, and he told him, you have to keep your business closed on Shabbos. The guy told him, what are you talking about? I make 4,000 ruble a day. You expect me to lose 4,000, maybe it's not ruble, ruble is a lot. I make 4,000, whatever the minor denomination of ruble. I make a sizable amount of money every day, and you expect me to give away 1/7 of my parnasa? You expect me to give away? There's not a chance. And he told him this pasuk. He says, listen, you're not making anything. It's sheshes yomim te'aseh melacha. The work gets done on its own. Vayom ha-shvi'i tishbot. You have to rest on the seventh day, and that's part of the condition of te'aseh melacha. If you don't rest on the seventh day, in fact, it might be counterproductive to your business. And he refused to believe him, and of course you can anticipate the end of the story. Certainly, Gassner, Noah, you could anticipate the end of the story. The Bolsheviks take over the Russian terrain, and they seize all, or not all, but they seize many, many companies and factories, including this person's factory. He was left totally destitute. He read Chafetz Chaim, you were totally right, I was totally wrong, where do I go from here? And, the Chafetz Chaim helped him out with some stock, try to put him back on his feet. But that's the notion of Te'aseh Melacha. We have to recognize that we do our Ishtadlis, but really HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately dictates what's going to be. I think Rav Judah was telling me that whatever was it, when he has to go to the mechanic, inevitably every time you go to the mechanic for anyone, it's, minimum 1,000, 2,000 shekel. They just find things. You know. He says, he walks into like 4,000 shekel. Was Rosh Hashanah, Kadosh Baruch had already decided that on Rosh Hashanah. I can pretend like it's hurting me now, but it doesn't. It was all decided on Rosh Hashanah. Te'aseh melacha. Okay, this, by the way, also helps if we can add a little bit on our own. The next part of the pasuk, right after Shabbos, what is it that Moshe speaks to the Jewish people about right after Shabbos? What's specific about the Mishkan?
Truma.
Truma, right? It's much easier to give tzedakah when you realize that it's te'aseh melacha. Right? Perhaps Moshe was purposely teaching them the Te'aseh Melacha right before he was about to take up a donation, because he was teaching them, listen, the money that you're holding right now is really not, you know, it's really all determined by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore you should give it. Okay. It's an interesting way that the Pasuk phrases, and it's a repetition of what we had in Truma, but we weren't here in Truma. Pasuk Hey, Lamed Hey, it says, Chumi Itchem Truma LaHashem. Take from yourselves a truma. What does that mean, take from yourselves a truma? What should it have really said?
Give truma.
Give. Tnu. Tnu truma. Why does it say chu truma? So in the Sefer Yalkut Lekachtov, I have it by my makom over there. So there's a story, oh, again, by Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was a Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. And Volozhin Yeshiva, it's not easy to keep a yeshiva afloat. And the Volozhin Yeshiva, they needed to raise a certain amount of money in order to keep it open. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik went to a certain town where there were some gvirim, and he went to raise money. Now, the way they raised money in those days, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik doesn't actually go from door to door and raise the money. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik goes to somebody's house, and he says, I'm here to raise money. And then the person, the gabbai, is the one that goes through the town, tries to raise money, while Rav Chaim Soloveitchik sits and he learns. That's, you know, and it's great for the town to have a tzaddik in their midst, learning during you know, however long he's there for. So Rav Chaim gets there, he gets to some gvir's house, to some person's house, and he says, I'm here to ask your help to help me raise money for the yeshiva. He says, no problem. You settle in the house, and I'll go collect the money. About a week or a week and a half later, Rav Chaim turns to him and he says, no, vazeter matzav, what's going on with the funds? He says, good, Baruch Hashem, we're doing nicely. We've gotten already half the money. And then, but another 2 weeks after that, so Rav Chaim Soloveitchik says, no, did we meet? He's like, yeah. We just got the last dollar that you needed, the last ruble that you needed. You're all good to go. He gave him the money, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik went back to Volozhin. A month or so later, comes back this wealthy man, and he's followed by another wealthy man from the same town, and he wants the Din Torah. What's the Din Torah? The Din Torah, it says to Rav Chaim, is you came to the town to raise money, and this guy, whom you stayed at, gave all the money. He wouldn't let me participate in the mitzvah. I also want to support the Volozhin Yeshiva. I want to give half the amount. I want to give. So, Paskin Vodi Paskin. But Rav Chaim Soloveitchik turns to the guy and he says, I don't understand. You gave all the money? So why is it that you didn't give it to me all at once? Why did you first give me half and then 2 weeks later you gave me nothing? Why didn't you just give it to me? I assumed that you were collecting it from other people. So he says, you don't understand. It's not a simple matter to give tzedakah. In order to really give tzedakah, you want to give it b'lev shalom. You want to give it with absolute conviction, for lack of a with a real sense of, I desire to do this. It's very hard for a person to part with his ostensibly hard-earned money. You think that you work hard, right? It's hard. And I wanted to make sure that there's lev shalom. So I kept on needing to convince myself day in day that this is something I really wanted to do. And when I finally felt that I truly wanted to do it, that's when I give you the money. That's the notion of chumi itchem truma. Take a truma. You have to work on yourselves, right, in order to do it. It doesn't come easy, but you have to work on yourselves in order to be on the level of truly giving a truma in the truest sense of the world, of the word. All right.
I don't really get how take represents that.
Because it's confirming for us that it's not just a matter of no skin off my back, I'll just give. It's a process. Take is an active process of I'm working on myself, I'm taking, and then I'm... Okay. We have over here a list of items that were used in the Mishkan. Zahav, v'chesef, v'nechoshes, v'tcheles, v'argaman, v'tilat, sheni, v'shes, v'izim, v'orot elima, odamim, v'orot chashim, v'teshitim. Right, we have gold, silver, nechoshes, bronze, copper, tcheles, argaman, right, tilat, sheni, v'shes, v'izim. The enumeration of these items goes from most expensive to least expensive, which is what we would have anticipated. There's gold, there's silver, there's copper or bronze, there is... The only question is that last on the list is Avnei Shoam ve'Avnei Miluim, is the precious stones. And precious stones are the most expensive item. Right, if you, any of you will have siblings that have gotten engaged, or you know from your parents, the hard part of an engagement ring, if you're so inclined to buy one for your fiancé, is not financing the actual band. The band is, relatively speaking, affordable-ish. The expensive part is actually the diamond that you're going to put in it. The stones, the precious stones are a lot more expensive. So the question is, why are the precious stones not the first on the list? It should say Avnei Shoam, the Avnei Miluim, Tcheles Vargaman, etc., etc., etc. So why is it that the Avnei Shoam are last on the list? Okay? There is two answers to this question. One we'll give now. Second one we'll give later on. The Medrash says that the Avnei Shoam came from good, from the Anonim, from the Anonei HaKavod. Very good. Every day when the man would come, so there was a layer of dew, and a layer of man, and then a layer of dew, and interspersed with all the man were precious stones. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would rain down precious stones onto the earth every day. Right? And they would go and collect man, and oh, you know what, while I'm at it, oh, this is a nice looking diamond, this is a nice looking ruby, this is a nice looking sapphire. I'm out of stone, so.
Emerald,
thank you. Right, that's nice, it's pleasant, etc. So, but, the point is, says the Or HaChaim, he actually says it back in Parshas Truma, the point is, says the Or HaChaim, that the stones were what we call no skin off their back. To give a stone was a piece of cake. It just was plopped down on the doorstep and involved no work, it involved, and you knew that more would come, I give this, more will come. There was no effort. There was no mysterious nefesh.
There's no loss.
Because there's nothing in it that was difficult. And because there was nothing in it that was difficult, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't appreciate it as much as he appreciates our struggles and our difficulties. When we come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we say we're struggling with this, but we're trying, that's a lot more appreciated than the precious stones. The gold and silver is true, they got from the Egyptians, but it was not easy to get that from the Egyptians, because you have to understand that after 210 years of slavery, to be able to then turn to your captives and demand from them gold and silver is not an easy thing. It's a total change of mentality, and it required a certain amount of Mesiras Nefesh. The stones that they just found on their doorstep, that was easy to part with and give. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not appreciate that as much as the Zahav, Kesef, Nchoshes, Tcheles, Vargaman. There was no Mesiras Nefesh involved in that. And that's a message that we have to keep on repeating to ourselves. Sometimes we sit in the Beis Midrash and we accomplish whatever it is we're set to accomplish. Let's say a teacher gives us a certain amount to learn, and we learned that amount, and it was no skin off our back, and we got through it, but we didn't push ourselves at all. So I don't want to minimize the accomplishment, and it's wonderful to just learn the Daf Gemara, and if it came easily, it came easily, and it's nice that it came easily. But recognize that that's not the measure of your commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The measure of your commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is when it doesn't come nicely, and despite that fact, you still sit there, and you commit yourself, and you struggle with, and that is entirely precious in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even if ultimately, at the end of the day, you did not accomplish as much as you would have hoped to accomplish. Okay.
So why would they use these like so-called precious, non-precious stones for the most valuable question? Yeah.
I don't understand the question. Why would they?
The question seems to be a pretty big deal compared to like the drapery of
right.
Why would they use like non-worthy stones for saying that?
But saying it's, why didn't we have a piece of cloth inside the koshen instead of
a piece of gold?
I think there's a practical notion of here that you need 12 different stones to represent 12 different tribes, and they are objectively, by world standards, they are the most beautiful of the. And there's a certain amount of splendor and glory that you want in the Mishkan as well. But probably the holiest thing we have is the tzitz. And the tzitz is made from zahav. The tzitz is not made from the the plate that the Kohen Gadol wore on top of his. Okay. Pasuk Chaf Zion. No. Pasuk Chaf. Right? After they list everything that that they needed and everything they need to bring, right? So Moshe dismissed the people. What does it say? Vayetzu kol adav bnei Yisrael milifnei Moshe. The people, the entire assembly, left from Moshe. So, Rav Elia Lupian, I think Rav Shach mentioned him, yeah. Rav Shach mentioned him in his speech on in his question and answers on, what day was it, Monday?
Eliyahu, his name?
Rav Eliyahu Lupian. He has a sefer called Lev Eliyahu. So he says, it's a little bit of a strange pasuk. Why does it need to tell us, Vayetzu kol adav bnei Yisrael milifnei Moshe, that they all left? We didn't need to know that, meaning we know that there's Vayakel, he gathered them. We could have gone straight into Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Vayavo kol ish asher nasa libo, everyone that was moved to give came and gave. So we would have known that they left, and then they went home. They looked inside their closets and said, yeah, I want to give this, and I want to give that. Why does it have to tell us, Vayetzu kol adav bnei Yisrael milifnei Moshe, that they left? Why is that so critical? Says Rav Elia Lupian, the critical part is not necessarily that they left, but it's Vayetzu kol adav bnei Yisrael milifnei Moshe. The pasuk says that they left from Moshe. There is, says Rav Elia Lupian, the ability to tell where a person has been, right? Just by looking at him. Sometimes you could look at a person and say, "Ah, oh, I can tell you just came from the gym." Right? Oh yeah, really, what gave it away, you know? You go, well, you know, the shorts, the body odor, the sweat, whatever it is. Or I could tell you just came back from, you know,
Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, you know, the suntan, the whatever. Or I could tell you just came back from a very inspiring, right, there's a certain glow, there's a certain, and that perhaps connects to the first point we had with the Vayakel and the light. It was easily discernible that they were just lifnei Moshe, that these people just stood in front of Moshe. They were sufficiently inspired. Sometimes you spend time next to a great person, and just being next to them is inspiring. And I'm trying to hang out with some of your Rebbeim here at Leva Torah, and you'll see that it's just an inspirational experience to, you know, go shopping with Rav Uri, Rav Asher, Rav Natanel, and Rav Kual. I don't want to say any. We know it to be true. So just hang out. There's a certain milifnei Moshe that was evident in them, and that's what the pasuk stresses. To tell us and remind us that the company we keep is important and impacts us in a very, very real way. You hang around with derelicts, and you'll become a derelict. You hang around with people that are positive influences, and you too will pay it forward, Bezrat Hashem, and become a positive influence. Somebody just sent me online. A scary video where, I guess it's more about chinuch, but it's a similar point, where they show a woman, a mother going up an escalator, and she's smoking, and they have like a six-year-old walking behind her, smoking. And then you see like a parent walking in the street just drinking, I don't know if it was a beer or not, or if it was a soda, whatever it is, and drops up the can on the floor, and a four-year-old walking behind them drinking, dropping the can on the floor. And then you see a husband, lo aleinu, raising his arm to beat, you know, they show from the West for something like he's about to punch his wife, and you see his six-year-old son also right next to him, about to punch his wife. We have to recognize that, you know, we are impacted by who we hang out with, and vice versa. Also, we have to recognize that we are impacting whoever hangs out with us. You know, they're gonna say, ah, I can just tell that you hung out with Yehuda Bromberg, and the question is, how are you able to tell that I just hung out with Yehuda Bromberg? How are you able to tell that I just hung out with Zach Minzer, with Jacob Adamlansky? Is it because I'm acting in a wonderful way and I look inspired? Or is it because I'm chas v'shalom doing things that are unbecoming? Right? And that's something that we have to keep in mind in terms of who we hang out with and the image that we want to project for the people that hang out with us and the responsibility that we have as we have to recognize that we are impacting them. Okay. We're going to get back to the question of the Avnei Shor. It says in Pasuk Chaf Zayin, Who was it that brought the precious stones? None other than the Nesim. The Nesim are, of course, the heads of the tribes. But there is something fascinating about the word Nesim over here. If you look at it inside, you will observe that has no yud in it. Normally, Nesi has a yud in it. Right between the... Right? Normally, it's Nun, Sin, Yud, Aleph. Right? And the C is usually with the Yud between. The Yud is gone. Now, I don't mean to make a little, you know, a man out of a molehill, but a Yud is a pretty big deal. Like when Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to save the Yehoshua from the Maraglim, he did it by giving him a Yud to his name. Yud is not something that should just be scoffed at. So the fact that there is no mention of a Yud over here is a pretty big deal. So why is there no yud over here? So Rashi says, at the very end of Rashi and Pasuk of Zayin, Rashi says, "Ulefi," right? What was the background to this? The Nesim said the following: "We are going to sit back and observe. Moshe, whatever you're missing at the end, we promise we will take out our checkbooks and we will give you whatever is missing." The Tzibor ended up bringing everything, and all that was left for them to bring at the end was the Avnei Shom and Avnei Miluim. But at first glance, one would ask himself, whoa, that's awesome. Imagine the Flava Torah had a, what do they call them nowadays in modern language? A sugar daddy, right? I think that's what they call them in the fundraising world, which is a little bit crude and crass. But imagine if they had a sugar daddy that said, listen, whatever the budget is, you fundraise whatever you can. If you're missing anything at the end of the year, Rav Boaz, I'm going to fill the gap. You will never have a deficit at Leishiva Leva Torah. Right? That's awesome. So, what, you know, it doesn't seem so bad what the Nesim did over here. But Rashi, in his infinite, perhaps, Ruach HaKodesh, he tells us that there was one small detail that was remiss over here. Lefi shanit atzlu mitchila. They were lax at the beginning. Were lazy at the beginning. Right? They could have done the same thing. They could have given something and then also said, hey, listen, whatever's missing at the end, we're going to make it up. But they did nothing. Meaning they put themselves into a situation where, on the one hand, commendable, but on the other hand, it was reflective of a little bit of laziness. Rashi says it, not me. Because they were a bit lazy initially, that's why they do not have the yud. Right? And the Sifter Chachamim says, even though afal gav shenitkavnu l'tova, even though they had good intentions, nevertheless, it's atzlus. Right? Because it's good to say, maybe everyone else will do what we're doing also, everyone will just wait for somebody else to give. There was a little bit of laziness over here, and because there was laziness, it was no good.
That's specifically the yud?
What?
What specifically the yud?
Well, because if he would have taken out any other letter, it wouldn't have spelled the same word anymore. So I guess that's the only letter that you could have taken
out. Good point.
So there's a... And this, by the way, can relate to the question that we asked before. Why is it that the Avnei Shom and Avnei Miluim are listed last? Because the Avnei Shom and Avnei Miluim were tainted somewhat by laziness. There's a tshuva. It's a fascinating tshuva. I don't remember who wrote it now, but it's pretty ancient. It's about 300 years old, 400 years old. And there was this fascinating invention that somebody invented. It's called a Lazy Susan. You guys know what a Lazy Susan is?
No.
Right? You sit at a table. They have them sometimes in restaurants on like these sushi bars or whatever. Maybe I think. I don't need sushi, but I think.
Round table.
Right? And the way it works is there's like 9 or 10 trays. And on each tray there's, let's say, chicken fingers and whatever it may be. And you sit in the same seat. And the thing goes around every 3 minutes. So like now you're able to take chicken, and then 3 minutes later it's going to move one tray over, and now I could
That's
take
so cool.
the meat, and now it moves over. It's called the Lazy Susan, because all you do is sit in your place, and it comes to you, right?
What did Susan ever do?
I don't know why.
There's
somebody years ago, but again, there's a tshuva about this. 300, 350 years ago, there was a person that brought a lazy Susan into the Beis Medrash. Sfarim, that would come around to you, that you wouldn't have to get up. Right, so it wasn't on the timer, but let's say you had a section for the Gemara, and a section for the Rambam, and a section for the Tanakh, and then whenever you needed a sefer, instead of getting up, you would just, you know, slide it over. Yeah, now I have my Tanakh. And then I need another sefer, okay, slide it over, and now I have my Gemara. Now, you never had to get up. And they asked this Rav what he thought, and he thought, this is terrible, because it's atzus, because it's laziness. This was before it was called lazy Susan, I assume, but he says, this is laziness. There's no way that your Talmud Torah can be a successful endeavor if you're always looking for shortcuts. Even if the shortcuts are in the seemingly trivial details like, oh, what are you talking about? It's less time. You know, a lot of people would rationalize it. It's less time this way. I don't have to get up and look for it on the shelf. It just comes to me right away. Is it no?
So
I think I heard the same thing about Rav Moshe Feinstein. I think about Rav Moshe Feinstein. They say that Rav Moshe Feinstein did not bring the shtender to him. He always leaned forward to his shtender. He didn't bring the shtender to him. I don't know if that was a notion of laziness, or if that was because he felt like I should go meet the Torah as opposed to the Torah come meet me. But one could stipulate that maybe it's the same notion. Yeah.
Come. I mean, like nowadays, when something more convenient, so isn't that like more? Is it more lazy? It's like online shiurim, online this. No, get up, go to shiur, or like online.
Look, there's obviously good things that can come out of it also. If a person is nowhere near a shir and that's his only avenue, then yeah. But given the choice, that's absolutely true. If you ask me, should I go to a shir or should I listen to one on, you know, the best Torah website out there in the world? I would say, they're all good. I'm saying I don't want to choose one. I would tell you, yeah, you should go to the shir. Even if you would maybe enjoy the shiur a little less, but something about going out there and putting yourself, I think does add a tremendous. It's a certain element that you just can't get from listening online. And I love online shiur. I mean, I listen to them all the time. But I make sure in my daily schedule I go to shiur once a week because I think it's very important for me to.
The rabbis say go to shiur too. Like, if you want to go to shiur, like, how does it work?
I go to Rav Lichtenstein for Moshe Lichtenstein. Each person has their own. We all answer to Rav Miller, and we all answer it, but happens to be that my Rebbe is Rav Lichtenstein. Okay. After the collection is done, so Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Vayomer Moshe al Bnei Yisrael." We're now in Lamed Hey Lamed. Vayomer Moshe al Bnei Yisrael. Moshe told Bnei Yisrael, you might be wondering now, how are we going to take all this gold and silver and raw material and turn it into a Mishkan? Re'u kara Hashem b'shem Betzalel ben Uri ben Chula Matayuda. Behold, God has called upon Betzalel ben Uri, the son of Ur, son of Chur, you know, from the tribe of Judah, of Yehuda, and he's going to take care of it. The question is on one word in this pasuk. Why does it say Re'u? Behold, Hashem called Betzalel ben Uri ben Chur. Why can't it just say Vayomer Moshe al Bnei Yisrael, Moshe told Bnei Yisrael, Kara Hashem b'shem Betzalel, Hashem has appointed Betzalel. Why do we have to hold Behold? Look at this. God appointed Betzalel. Why do we have to call their attention to the fact that God has appointed Betzalel? What's significant in that appointment? Okay. So, well, I guess we only have time for one word. So I'll tell you the Ramban. And incidentally, I have a son whose name is Betzalel, and it is not entirely unrelated to this Ramban. Ramban. Right? But the way you do it is it's a different inflection. When you're talking about Maimonides, you say Rambam. When you're talking about Nachmanides, you say Ramban. The stress is... Rambam, the stress is on the first syllable. Rambam, mil el, and then the Ramban, mil ra, it's on the second syllable. Rambam, Ramban. Okay. Anyway, the Ramban says the following. He says it's an amazing task that Betzalel was entrusted with. Let's just think of all the things that had to go into the construction of the Mishkan. You had to be an expert with precious metals, right? Gold, silver, etc. You had to be an expert with carpentry. There was a lot of woodworking that went into the Mishkan as well. You had to be an expert weaver. Now, it is difficult enough to become a master in just one of these areas, right? To become the master jeweler is you need to apprentice for many years, right? Hours upon hours of labor, right? Or in weavery, whatever it's called, weaving, and similarly in carpentry, and to be an expert in all three of them. Where does that come from? Added to the fact that he was a slave in Mitzrayim. So, and in Mitzrayim, he didn't really have access to this type of... Right, what was he doing in Mitzrayim? In Mitzrayim, he was building, you know, with bricks and mortar. So, how did this come from? Says Moshe, Rehu, behold, Bezalel. This is the ultimate proof that our talents are God-granted. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a purpose for every single one of us. He has a mission for every single one of us, and He gives us the kelim. He gives us the tools that we need in order to accomplish everything that we intend, that we're intended to accomplish. Asali kol tzarki, I think we had mentioned once before, the bracha that we make every morning, He has given me all that I need in order to succeed. Asali kol tzarki, I have what I need. And the proof is somebody like Bezalel. It doesn't just, how could it be? The answer is it can be because HaKadosh Baruch Hu grants it to be. And just like Moshe was telling them, and just like Bezalel, as predetermined, you know, so too I want you to know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given you, behold, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given you kochos, He's given you capabilities, and I want you to try to, in some measure, figure out what those capabilities are and use them for a Mishkan building on your own, of your own responsibility and level. Okay? There's another beautiful Vort on Re'u, but unfortunately, our time has elapsed. Blina, there... I think there might be a Re'u in Parshas Vayakhela, in Parshas Pekudei actually. So we might be able to get it in.
Stay tuned for next week.
I don't think so. Maybe it's a bit. All right.